This mortal coil.
Well, around Easter time on Nightlife, we looked at the life of Jesus the man and what we know from the historical record. Tonight, we're going to try and find out about the life of the man who became the Buddha. But that's pretty hard considering the Buddha lived 400 years before Jesus. Well, about that anyway. Dr. Jim Reingarns is a lecturer in Tibetan Buddhism at Sydney University. He's actually the only holder of a Tibetan Buddhist lectureship in Australia. And he joins us now on Nightlife. Thanks so much for coming in tonight.
Okay, hello. Welcome.
Hello. What sparked your interest in Buddhism and specifically Tibetan Buddhism?
One could say I had a general interest in, let's say, non-European cultures. And I had also been to India, which I found quite interesting. And then I heard about the possibility of learning Tibetan philosophy, studying it there. And since I had already started to study social anthropology at the university and we were encouraged to go abroad, I thought, let's just go and study with some Tibetan scholars, learn about Tibetan Buddhism. And then I started to get really interested into that and thought, well, I might as well learn the language because I would like to know what's written there, you know, about the histories and the philosophies. Mm. And I also discovered that basically only 5% of, or a very low percentage, is translated into Tibetan. And then, of course, I heard that the original, or the more original, like Indian texts, are mostly written in Sanskrit or Pali. So I thought I might have to learn that as well.
So you learned Sanskrit as well.
I tried my best. Let's put it like this. Wow. You know, learning is
it's not an easy thing to learn these ancient languages. So what do we know about the life of the Buddha? I mean, do we have ancient Sanskrit documents about his life, about before he became the Buddha, that spurred a whole faith and way of thinking about the world?
Well, I mean, in general, Indian history, because the Buddha was, lived in India, in Magadha, or northeastern part of India, is a bit challenging, you could say, because we usually don't have so many sources, especially no dates, but we have some texts. So you could say there are some texts indicating a kind of skeleton of what could be the historical Buddha, although actually to look at the historical Buddha is more the academic's concern. It has not always been the traditional concern, although there were discussions about the dates of the Buddha for chronology's sake and so forth, to really find out what he did and what was historical, what was not, was not so important for the traditions. But we can find out, so we have some textual sources in Pali, which is a Middle Indian dialect, or let's say language. And then we have also later developed biographies, maybe in Sanskrit, and some of them are lost in Sanskrit. So those that are lost then are usually available, or sometimes available, in either classical Chinese or classical Tibetan.
Right. And are the Pali ones from around the time he lived or from later? I mean, we know that nothing was really written about Christ till more than 100 years after he died.
I mean, one could say that basically the beginning of the Buddhist traditions was mostly oral transmission on the one hand, and then one could say the first 300 years there were no complete biographies, but in the Buddhist canon, which was then kind of assembled over the years, there are fragments and indications and stories in different, let's say, sermons or sutras of the Buddha, what he did and so forth. And then only, let's say, the later biographical tradition, we have texts that are called, I just give some funky names, like yeah, Mahavastu or Ladita Vistara. These are complete biographies. And they are actually, you could say, I mean, if I remember correctly, I might have to check that again, is not earlier than the second century Christian era that we have complete accounts with all kinds of embellishments, you could say, and legends and so forth.
So added. That's 400 years possibly after he was around.
Yeah, even a bit more, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but of course, before we have written accounts, we have the Buddhist canon with kind of indications, some talks about previous existences and so forth. But from that, we could piece together some skeleton of what mm-hmm. could be
okay.
The historical
Buddha. All right, well, let's piece together some of it. When do we think he was born?
Yeah, that's already a point of debate. So,
I'm sure, yeah.
Although I have to say, it's the debate of Western, like Western is maybe a too simple term, but of academics and historians that discuss that at great length. So there has been a symposium in the 1980s in 1988 in Germany in Göttingen, where this was like discussed and had been proceedings and so forth, and it all boils down to relating it to King Ashoka, which was a like famous Indian king, and because of archaeological and other evidence, one can date King Ashoka. And then there's talk about the Buddha lived or died so and so many years before King
before
Ashoka.
Him. Well, he was a Buddhist king, wasn't he?
Yes,
yeah.
I mean that's
well,
he what he is. That's what he is termed. Like again, this is a big topic in itself. What happened with King Ashoka? But there we have Buddhist inscriptions. Like once he ruled, he became a Buddhist.
Yeah,
let's say.
Yeah,
and also we have the idea of the patriarchs or of the successors of the Buddha. And usually one would think that this is a more accurate information, because in Indian, let's say, history, this is more accurate. Like who was upholding the teaching is probably more accurate than different other dates. So
okay.
Since we could then, there's new information about the dates of Ashoka, one could think that older chronologies might have been slightly wrong. So
give us a ballpark.
Yeah, so the ballpark is basically, you could say now, I mean, I usually one tells to students, it's like the Buddha kind of lived the 5th century before Christian era, or he died between the 5th and the 4th century before Christian era, some say 420 to 350, and he lived approximately for 80 years.
80?
Yes.
Okay. So
approximately. I
right.
mean, this is what we know about the
yeah.
his life dates,
mm-hmm.
you could say.
Yeah. And do we know where? Because I've been to the Indian town that says it's the town where Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, and this is the tree that must be a very old tree by now, where he sat. Do we know exactly where he was from and where he did wander and teach? And
yes, I mean, to some extent we do, because let's say the one might distinguish into the really basic facts that if we look at the different earlier sources and also later sources, because they're all common, one has the idea that these were really, let's say, things that were common to that were happening at the Buddha's time. And we know he's from an area maybe called Magadha in north eastern areas of India, and some of the places that he has been teaching, there are fairly sometimes some of them are fairly well accounted for. So we think he's born in Lumbini, which is a town near on the border now. It's now in today's Nepal, and some of the places of teaching and also the place of his, let's say, enlightenment, Parinirvana, under the Bodhi tree.
Yeah.
This is fairly, let's say, probable that he was active in that area. So
and
we know
was
he
Bodh
was
Gaya,
active in that area,
that area.
In Bodh Gaya.
Mm.
And we know that he's from a kind of like local fiefdom in that area. This is probably belonging to the so-called Kshatriya caste. And then it is clear that at some point he went into homelessness, as you could call
right.
it. He left.
So was he a prince,
traditional
though?
Home.
I mean,
prince is a term that we now have. So he was a son of a noble, let's say, family. Later on, it was said a king and a prince, but you could say it's a local lord and a princely son. So
mm-hmm.
these are then kind of terms that we have,
mm.
and that later on, of course, the Buddha became a bit larger than life. One could say, but we know that he was one of the different mendicants, or let's say shamanas, because in India at that time there was great, let's say, openness and debate about religious issues, different yoga practitioners and mendicants that would do all kinds of practices and have different doctrines that were taught and debated.
Within Hinduism.
Yeah, Hinduism is a term that also is a later term.
Later
That Westerners invented.
Hindus,
there are so
yeah.
many different Indian religions,
yeah.
like religious traditions. And even some say today, like jokingly, the Buddha was not a Buddhist. Yeah, even the word Buddhism is kind of invented. So we know that he was around at that time, that he left the house, let's say, searching for a path. And he was among those different mendicants trying out different types of yogas and practices. And at some point he found something that is then later called awakening or enlightenment or liberation, moksha. So there are different terms on his search for overcoming, let's say, existential problems.
Pain
so,
and, yeah.
Yeah,
and
so suffering. You could say that the key teaching of the Buddha is I only teach suffering and its end. Yeah. So that's one sentence. And the other sentence is, which the Tibetans use quite often, is that to do whatever is beneficial and to avoid whatever is harmful and to train one's own mind. Mm. That's the teaching of the Buddha.
And that was for him, that was through meditation. So I mean, the story is that he sat under the tree for weeks or months till his body was wasting away and until he achieved enlightenment. He just kept meditating. How much do we know about the actual practices that he did do?
Well, as I said, now we are still in the early kind of phase where we try to find out what's historical. I mean, we know that, I mean, that's why he practiced austeric, like, or ascetic practices. And, I mean, the story later on emphasizes, and that's usually what becomes important as an example. First, he indulged more in a very nice and lush, let's say, lifestyle, being skilled in arts and crafts. And so forth, as a kind of prince, if you will. And then when he did ascetic practices, he did that very extreme. But that also didn't lead. So the starving and extreme practices also didn't lead him to the goal. So he started to accept food. And only then did he sit down under the Bodhi tree. So we know he did practices that would calm the mind, or shamatha, so let's say very focused concentration. But meditation, again, is a very rough term. So focus, concentration, different states of absorption. But what the Buddha is said to have discovered is the, let's say, the idea of maybe non-self, or so-called Four Noble Truths. What's the cause of all, let's say,
suffering.
Issues?
Yeah,
suffering is also, again, like, not only some things we would call suffering, because then we are old and sick and die, so we say suffering, but from the Buddha's perspective, unenlightened or conditioned experience, maybe.
Yeah.
Because even a state of great happiness is changing, so it's inherently, let's say, changing. So we would call it, maybe it's a bit dissatisfactory, but we wouldn't call it suffering. So that the Pali term dukkha covers a bit more than just suffering. It's just, let's say, conditioned happiness also is included.
And are there accounts of his early teachings and people who, because he began to teach people and they would gather and listen to him?
The key teaching, the first kind of sermon, which I mentioned before, and basically is about the Four Noble Truths. So sometimes said pointing out, like, say, existential issues that people have. So it's very pragmatic. So you could think he comes with a huge philosophy, but he basically says, I tell you, there is dukkha, there is suffering, there are problems, and there is a cause for it. And there's the, let's say, there's a cessation of it, so it can be completely removed if the cause is removed, and there's the path towards this. So that then later traditions say that you should view the Buddha as the doctor, yourself as sick, and the teaching is the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take it as prescribed, you'll get healthy.
You'll be healthy.
So you can get healthy again. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
We're talking to Dr. Jim Rangans on Nightlife. He is a lecturer in Tibetan Buddhism at Sydney University. So he began teaching. Do we know much more about the rest of his life after he taught the Buddhist doctrines? I know that a lot of Buddhists think that he died of a stomach ache or something. That's what the local folklore is. Yeah.
Yeah, we know that he died of probably something like diarrhea, based on some, let's say,
based that's a more on, clear on way food. Of putting it.
based on bad food, and of course, there's big debate, like what exactly he ate. You know, was it a piece of meat or this and that, because of the terminology. But I mean, the rest of
did
his
he
life.
Eat meat?
Wouldn't yeah, that's another issue. We don't really know what this word means, but in the Buddhist canon, the Buddha ate what he was offered, because the mendicants, they would go for alms begging at a certain time of the day, and so one would have to eat what is offered. And so the main activity, of course, we know is like living in the household, leaving the household, doing different practices, finding his enlightenment, or not only his, but enlightenment, and then teaching. So teaching activity is for 45 years. So you could say it's the largest part of his life is to teach and to start the Buddhist, let's say, community, which is called Sangha. So today's Buddhists view these three things as most important. The Buddha as the goal, this teaching, the Dharma as the path, and the Sangha as the kind of community that's practicing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, the teaching activity, founding the community, traveling and being in retreat and so on, that was kind of main activities. And as I said, we know he did that. Of course, later traditions tell us much more about what he did. But the largest thing that's basically available, or the let's say a thing not, but the bulk of textual material and also practices transmitted today is about the teaching, the Dharma. So,
and how much, and can we track through that how much they changed as he taught over those 45 years? I mean, it's a long time. How much did he refine his teachings and the basic philosophies, or did they stay the same?
Well, one could say they were never the same. So as sometimes, as you say,
same,
but different, as you hear sometimes also in India. So you could, because that's one of the features, because you would maybe expect a coherent.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a kind of, you could argue there is a kernel of teachings and a kind of a general direction of the teaching. But then because, you find... also these anecdotes in the different sutras, it's always different people. So the teaching is different at different occasions, giving to different students of different capacities. So if you look at early and even later development, some scholars would say the main point is not to have a doctrinal edifice built up of the Buddha's teaching, but to teach people so they can reach a goal, which is less problems, you know, in this life, or possibly, you know, through accumulating positive, good, beneficial actions, and even possibly liberation
from eternal rebirth.
Yeah, even then later Buddhist traditions, even talking about enlightenment for the benefit of beings, so not only for oneself, but for others. That's why some explain all these different approaches and emphasis, because the Buddha taught at different occasions.
A lot of people in India now, Dalits often, the untouchables, will convert to Buddhism because it's a faith, it's considered a faith of no caste, whereas in Hinduism you're more set in life with your caste. Was that something he explicitly talked about?
Of course, we don't really sometimes know what he talked about, so that's still debate, but... this was not important. So it was clear that everyone had the potential to reach the Buddhist goal, liberation or enlightenment. And everyone in later philosophy, they would even call this Buddha nature, which is a specific later.
Was that radical
trend
at the time, though? Just to
in a certain sense, yes, because in a certain sense. But there were other mendicants that had also different types of philosophies, maybe similar. But yes, I mean, what you were talking about, which is sometimes also based on Ambedkar and later movements, is a kind of modern like Buddhist modernism, like trying to find what is useful for practitioners now or for different, let's say, movements now. But of course, this was not important at all for the Buddha. And also, there's the discussion that at some point he also admitted like women to the order, which after some discussion, and that's a whole field in itself, but that was at that time also, you could say, revolutionary to even say that everyone can reach can reach this goal. I mean, at this time
you didn't have to be a member of, say, the priestly caste.
No.
Yeah.
So that was quite explicit that was not important. So that was something new. And what was also a new, let's say, you could say maybe innovation, an important one, is the Buddha would emphasize that, let's say, the thought impulse is already action. So thinking is too simplified, but what you think or what the mind is kind of directing itself towards is already kind of karma, is action.
Yeah.
Well, so it's not only what you do outwardly, it's also what your motivation is.
Yeah, because thought dictates action, which dictates behavior.
In a way. So that was, because there were common ideas about that, but that was also a kind of, let's say, fairly new.
Radical.
Maybe not radical, but a certain impulse. Yeah.
Right.
But, I mean, you could also argue that, as I said, if you look at the early life, the Buddha was one of the many mendicants and the many traditions that were there, and he had started his, he had his order and so forth, and only even the name like ascribed to him, Buddha, the Awakened One, yeah, that was a kind of...
It wasn't his name. Yeah.
Wasn't his original name, but
the Enlightened One.
Yeah, or Awakened One, like from Buddha. And I think I may be wrong there, but I think in Polish there still you find this Budnik or something is the alarm clock waking you up or something like that. So you can find this Indo-European root still today.
Isn't that interesting? And all the different representations of him are so interesting as well, aren't they? You know, get the fat Buddha and the skinny Buddha and...
Yeah, sure. That's according to the culture. But, I mean, the skinny Buddha is alluding to his life when he did ascetic practices.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's this very, let's say, Buddha where you can see the almost like a skeleton where you can see the ribs and everything.
I mean, there's so many people who have sculptures of Buddha and it's always this beautiful being. I mean, do we have any idea what he looked like? Was that any of that in the records?
Yeah, that's, again, a different... let's say that's more the art historical question and then how the Buddha is depicted. But in the beginning, it was not like so important to think of the bodily form. So that's why we don't know that for sure. So that developed. Yeah, well, I mean, there were, of course, later on you find texts that, let's say later, if you look at historian, you find, of course, later text that says he looks like a superhero. Yeah, basically described like a superhero with these like 32 minor and major and 80 minor marks of beauty. So this is a later development,
of course,
which is kind of very, you could say, schematic. And then he has this long, long ear lobes. But these are later descriptions. So what he really looked like is difficult
to
say.
Idea. Yeah.
What was important was the teaching and to remember the Buddha as the teacher. And then he left also the relics. So the relics that he left, like when he died, or this idea of the Buddha's bones still being in the world, became kind of an important representative
of
the Buddha.
What do they think? They really have his bones. They're the relics, but...
Yes, and then they would be put sometimes in early, like the idea is to put him in a stupa, so the Buddha would still be present.
Right.
But although it was always clear that the most important is to apply the Buddha's teaching.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So but do we know if those bones are really his? I mean, you know, it's like the cross that Jesus was crucified on. If we put all those bits of wood around the world that people think of the cross of Jesus, we'd have a cross bigger than a 10-story building.
Sure. No, I'm not an expert in this field, but I think we don't know.
Yeah.
But there's a nice Tibetan story that sometimes is told. So the main point is also not whether it's the... the Buddhist traditions are aware it doesn't matter. So there's a story of a Tibetan woman who asks her son to bring back a bone of the Buddha, and he kind of forgot. So he brought a dog's bone, but she was so faithful to it, it didn't matter. Because he told her it's the Buddha's, like, it's a relic of the Buddha. So she was very inspired by it. So the main point is, and that's what people know, like what the traditions know, is if it inspires one to apply the practice, it's fine.
Matter. Just practice.
It's fine.
Practice.
So that's then the Buddha as an example of the practice, or the state of the Buddha as a goal. So they were kind of aware. So they would say, oh, yeah, it doesn't matter whether he lived this time or that time. I mean, or whether he was of this caste or that caste, or in which...
The teachings still stand.
Teachings stand, and main point is that one will die and at some point, and so what to do with it. Yeah, so that would be an approach of the traditions themselves.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about the life of Buddha tonight.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Dr. Jim Reingarns. He's from Sydney University and he's a lecturer in Tibetan Buddhism there. And he also teaches Sanskrit and soon possibly Tibetan.
This is Nightlife with Sarah McDonald on ABC Radio.